Good evening. Thank you for coming. My name is Alan Pally, and I'm producer of public programs at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. During this week of commemoration and of hope, we take particular pleasure in inaugurating Mystic Chords of Memory, our series celebrating the bicentennial of Abraham Lincoln. We have 8 public programs scheduled between tonight and March 21st, as well as a display of music materials related to Lincoln, including original manuscripts by the composer Gottschalk, in our third floor reading room. I want to thank the participants on tonight's program, who are among the thousands of artists and lecturers who make our series possible through the generous donation of their time and talent. Emerson called Lincoln a man who was at home and welcome with the humblest, and with a spirit and a practical vein in the times of terror that commanded the admiration of the wisest. His heart was as great as the world, but there was no room in it to hold the memory of a wrong. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Eric Foner, Dana Ivey, and James Rebhorn.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Eric Foner from Columbia University, and I'm going to just give a little bit of historical background to the Lincoln-Douglas debates before we actually hear the excerpts from our two, from Lincoln and Douglas, who are sitting over here. Guess which is which. Well, they actually change at one point, but... Now, Lincoln has been in the news a lot lately, as you know, not only because the bicentennial of his birth is coming up in about 2 weeks, but also because President Obama has sort of channeled Lincoln in various ways, or perhaps a better way of putting it is tried to model himself on some of Lincoln's characteristics. Both of them are from Illinois, of course. Both of them became prominent national figures through their oratory, through speeches. Neither of them had much of a national political career before becoming president. Lincoln had one term in Congress, Obama 4 years in the Senate, but it was really speeches that made both of them major national figures, eloquence, oratory, etc. Now, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which are really one of the most famous in political encounters in American history, took place in 1858. The first thing I guess it's worth pointing out is that Lincoln was not well known at that time. Stephen A. Douglas, the senator from Illinois who he was debating, was probably the most prominent political figure in the country. Today we might remember Douglas as the man who debated Lincoln, but Lincoln was the guy who debated Douglas, and that's what made Lincoln a national figure, that he was actually able to debate the great Stephen A. Douglas and fight him to more or less a draw. Lincoln had, as you know probably, been born in Kentucky, a slave state. As a young boy, his family moved to Indiana, and then he moved to Illinois, and he had a career in Illinois politics in the 1830s and 40s in the legislature. He served his one term in Congress, at which point he strongly opposed the Mexican War. This will come up in one of the debates. He'll be accused, as you hear, of sort of reminiscent of today, of not supporting the troops when they were out fighting. Lincoln had this unusual idea that the president should not just be able to start a war all by himself on fictitious grounds, and he said that very explicitly in Congress. This was not a popular opinion, however, and he wasn't even renominated to run again in 1848. And in fact, he thought his political career was basically over. He then spent the next several years just in his law career. But in 1854, Lincoln came back into politics because Stephen A. Douglas, who was the senator from Illinois and a much more prominent figure, had introduced in Congress and gotten to pass through Congress the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened up a large part of the Western territories to the possible expansion of slavery. Up to that point, the status of slavery had been pretty much fixed in every part of the country. The northern states had abolished slavery, the southern states had slavery, And there was this Missouri Compromise from many years before, which divided the Western territories between slave and free areas. But Douglas changed that in his bill of 1854, opening up what had been guaranteed to freedom, that is, places like Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, etc., to the possible expansion of slavery if the local people wanted it. His principle was what he called popular sovereignty. Let the people of each territory decide whether they wanted slavery or not. That, he said, was democratic and in keeping with American traditions. Lincoln was horrified by this. Lincoln was an anti-slavery guy, but he hadn't really made a big issue of slavery in his previous political career. But he and many, many Northerners felt that this was the violation of a long-standing sectional compromise, and that it would open up a vast new area to the expansion of slavery, and in fact allow slavery to spread maybe even to the North eventually. So Lincoln played a role in the formation of the Republican Party, the modern Republican Party, which came into existence in 1854 and 1855 to stop the westward expansion of slavery. It was not about abolishing slavery, it was about stopping slavery from spreading any further. Although, as you will hear, Lincoln also insisted that eventually slavery had to end. He talked about the ultimate extinction of slavery, a somewhat vague term because it was unclear when that ultimate would be, but still he made it very clear that he thought eventually slavery would have to end. Now, Lincoln is nominated to run as the Republican candidate for the Senate in 1858 in Illinois against Douglas, who's running for re-election. Now, senators today are generally, except in New York State, chosen by popular vote. Here, the governor chooses the senator. But at that time, the senator was elected by the members of the legislature. So the campaign is really to get people to vote for people running for the legislature who will support one or another of these candidates. In fact, it was quite unusual to have the candidates already set before the election. Usually a lot of bargaining took place afterwards about who were going to be selected for the Senate. But at the Republican National Convention, Republican State Convention in Illinois in 1858, the Republican Party there said, Lincoln is our candidate. And Lincoln at that convention delivered one of his most famous speeches, which we will in a minute hear an excerpt from, the House Divided speech. And that launched the campaign. Now, eventually, Lincoln basically started following Douglas around Illinois. Douglas would give a speech, and the next day Lincoln would turn up in the same place and give a speech. And Douglas got annoyed about this. And it seemed a little unseemly for Lincoln. So Lincoln eventually challenged Douglas to a series of debates. And eventually they agreed to hold these seven debates in various pretty small towns, really, places of 5,000 or 10,000 people scattered through Illinois. Illinois itself was divided something like the nation. Northern Illinois was settled from the east and was pretty anti-slavery. Southern Illinois had been settled from Virginia, Kentucky, slave states, and was not anti-slavery, although they didn't have slavery in Illinois at all. And the center of Illinois, where Lincoln lived, Springfield, was like the swing part of the state. So as I will point out as we go along, what they said in different parts of the state varied a bit because of the different political opinions in northern, central, and southern Illinois. Now, unlike debates today, these were really debates. They didn't have Tom Brokaw or Gwen Ifill bothering them. And they didn't have short attention spans like we do today. The first guy would get up and speak for an hour. Extemporaneously, they did not have written out speeches. The second candidate would get up and speak for an hour and a half in rebuttal. And then the first one would come back and speak for another half hour. So these were 3-hour events. Thousands of people attended. They took place outdoors. People stood for 3 hours listening to these debates. And the debates, some of them touched on rather trivial issues, which are really of no importance to us today, but they focused on the main issue confronting the country, which was the future of slavery. Should slavery expand? What were the intentions of the founding fathers about slavery? What rights should black people have? Illinois was a deeply racist state, even though it was a free state. In fact, the law of Illinois made it illegal for any black person to enter the state at all. They did not want a free black population any more than a slave population. And you will hear things by Lincoln that may surprise you, where he's trying to express himself in a very, very racist environment. And before we begin, one other thing. One of the key issues in these debates is the impact of the Dred Scott decision. In 1857, the Supreme Court, in the case of Dred Scott, had ruled that Congress actually has no power to prevent slavery from expanding westward. The slave owners have a right to take their slaves into any territory they want. In effect, the platform of the Republican Party, which wanted to stop that, was deemed to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. But it also posed a problem for Douglas. If slavery cannot be stopped from going into a territory, what happens to this idea of popular sovereignty? That is, letting people decide. There's nothing to decide because the Supreme Court says slavery has to go. And that issue is debated. And this Dred Scott decision also said that no black person could be a citizen of the United States, that the Constitution only applies to white people. The most infamous phrase from that was Chief Justice Taney's comment, "A black man has no rights which a white man is bound to respect." That's the law of the land in 1857. But you'll hear about the Dred Scott decision in these debates. So without going any further, we will begin. I will introduce each little excerpt briefly from the debates, but we will begin with Abraham Lincoln and an excerpt from the House Divided speech in 1858 at the Republican convention that nominated him for the Senate.
If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could then better judge what to do and how to do it. We are now far into the fifth year since a policy was initiated with the avowed object and confident promise of putting an end to slavery agitation. Under the operation of that policy, the agitation has not only not ceased, but has constantly augmented. In my opinion, it will not cease until a crisis shall have been reached and passed. A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, north as well as south. Have we no tendency to the latter condition? We may ere long see another Supreme Court decision declaring that the Constitution of the United States does not permit a state to exclude slavery from its limits. Such a decision is all that slavery now lacks of being alike lawful in all the states. Welcome or unwelcome, such decision is probably coming and will soon be upon us unless the power of the present political dynasty shall be met and overthrown. We shall lie down pleasantly, dreaming that the people of Missouri are on the verge of making their state free, and we shall awake to the reality instead that the Supreme Court has made Illinois a slave state.
Now, the House Divided speech, as you will hear, becomes in itself a major point of debate in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I should add, as to avoid confusion, that we are now switching roles, and Lincoln will now become Douglas for the rest of the event here. The first debate took place in Ottawa, Illinois, in northern Illinois. Douglas begins, and as you will see, immediately tries, as a good debater, and both of them are very experienced debaters, to put Lincoln on the defensive. He launches a whole series of attacks upon Lincoln to make Lincoln have to defend himself rather than put his own views forward. He accuses him he says the House divided speech is a recipe for civil war. Why can't the country exist half slave and half free? It has since the time of the Constitution. What's the problem now? He tries to accuse Lincoln of being a radical abolitionist who favors, quote unquote, Negro equality, something that is certainly anathema to most of the audience in Illinois. Lincoln, as you'll hear, sort of tries to find the middle ground on these issues and finds himself put on the defensive. One other small point before we go forward, as you'll hear, Douglas accuses Lincoln of, in his youth, having been a grocery keeper. What's wrong with that? Well, a grocery keeper at that time meant a guy who basically sold liquor. And up in northern Illinois, there were a lot of religious people who did not approve of having a stout drink now and then. So Douglas accuses, Lincoln did run a shop in the town of New Salem a long time before, but you'll see this becomes a point of debate also. So Stephen A. Douglas is opening from the first debate. And then Lincoln's response.
In the remarks I have made on this platform, I mean nothing personally disrespectful or unkind to Mr. Lincoln. I have known him for nearly 25 years. There were many points of sympathy between us when we first got acquainted. We were both comparatively boys and both struggling with poverty in a strange land. I was a school teacher in the town of Winchester, and he a flourishing grocery keeper in the town of Salem. He was more successful in his occupation than I was in mine, and hence more fortunate in the world's goods. Lincoln is one of those peculiar men who perform with admirable skill everything which they undertake. I met him in the legislature and had a sympathy with him because of the uphill struggle we both had in life. He was then just as good at telling an anecdote as now. He could beat any of the boys in wrestling or running a foot race and pitching quoits or tossing a copper, could ruin more liquor than all of the boys in town together, and the dignity and impartiality with which he presided at a horse race or fist fight excited the admiration and won the praise of everybody that was present and participated. Whilst in Congress, he distinguished himself by his opposition to the Mexican War, taking the side of the common enemy against his own country. Why can the country not exist divided into free and slave states? Now, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Madison, Hamilton, Jay, and the great men of that day made this government divided into free states and slave states and left each state perfectly free to do as it pleased on the subject of slavery. Why can it not exist on the same principles on which our fathers made it? They knew when they framed the Constitution that in a country as wide and broad as this, with such a variety of climate, production, and interest, the people necessarily required different laws and institutions in different localities. They knew that the laws and regulations which would suit the granite hills of New Hampshire would be unsuited to the rice plantations of South Carolina. Here I assert that uniformity in the local laws and institutions of the different states is neither possible or desirable. If uniformity had been adopted when the government was established, it must inevitably have been the uniformity of slavery everywhere, or else the uniformity of Negro citizenship and Negro equality everywhere. We are told by Lincoln that he is utterly opposed to the Dred Scott decision and will not submit to it for the reason that he says it deprives the Negro of the rights and privileges of citizenship. That is the first and main reason which he assigns for his warfare on the Supreme Court of the United States in its decision, I ask you, are you in favor of conferring upon the Negro the rights and privileges of citizenship? Do you desire to strike out of our state constitution that clause which keeps slaves and free Negroes out of the state and allow the free Negroes to flow in and cover your prairies with black settlements? Do you desire to turn this beautiful state into a free Negro colony in order that when Missouri abolishes slavery, she can send 100,000 emancipated slaves into Illinois to become citizens and voters on an equality with yourselves? If you desire Negro citizenship, if you desire to allow them to come into the state and settle with a white man, if you desire them to vote on an equality with yourselves and to make them eligible to office, to serve on juries, and to adjudge your rights, well, then support Mr. Lincoln and the Black Republican Party who are in favor of the citizenship of the Negro. For one, I am opposed to Negro citizenship in any and every form. I believe this government was made on the white basis. I believe it was made by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever. And I am in favor of confining citizenship to white men and of European birth and descent, instead of conferring it upon Negroes, Indians, or other inferior races. I do not regard the Negro as my equal, and positively deny that he is my brother or any kin to me, whatever.
Anything that argues me into his idea of perfect social and political equality with the Negro is but a specious and fantastic arrangement of words by which a man can prove a horse chestnut to be a chestnut horse. I will say here, while upon this subject, that I have no purpose directly or indirectly to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so. I have no purpose to introduce political and social equality between the white and black races. There is a physical difference between the two, which in my judgment will probably forever forbid their living together upon the footing of perfect equality. And inasmuch as it becomes a necessity that there must be a difference, I, as well as Judge Douglas, am in favor of the race to which I belong having the superior position. I have never said anything to the contrary, but I hold that notwithstanding all this, there is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I hold that he is as much entitled to these as the white man. I agree with Judge Douglas. He is not my equal in many respects, certainly not in color, perhaps not in moral or intellectual endowment, but in the right to eat the bread without leave of anybody else, which his own hand earns, he is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas and the equal of every living man. Now I pass on to consider one or two more of these little follies. The judge is woefully at fault about his early friend Lincoln being a grocery keeper. I don't know as it would be a great sin if I had been, but he is mistaken. Lincoln never kept a grocery anywhere in the world. The great variety of the local institutions in the states, springing from differences in the soil, differences in the face of the country, and in the climate, are bonds of the Union. They do not make a house divided against itself, but they make a house united. But can this question of slavery be considered as among these varieties in the institutions of the country? I leave it to you to say whether, in the history of our government, this institution, slavery, has not always failed to be a bond of union and, on the contrary, been an apple of discord and an element of division in the House. The public mind did rest in the belief that it was in the course of ultimate extinction. But lately, I think, and in this I charge nothing on the judge's motives, lately I think that he and those acting with him have placed that institution on a new basis, which looks to the perpetuity and nationalization of slavery. And while it is placed upon this new basis, I say, and I have said, that I believe we shall not have peace upon the question until the opponents of slavery arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction. Or, on the other hand, that its advocates will push it forward until it shall become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, north as well as south. Now, I believe if we could arrest the spread and place it where Washington and Jefferson and Madison placed it, it would be in the course of ultimate extinction, and the public mind would, as for 80 years past, believe that it was in the course of ultimate extinction. The crisis would be past, and the institution might be let alone for 100 years, if it should live so long, in the states where it exists. Yet it would be going out of existence in the way best for both the black and the white races. As I think that slavery is to be made national, let us consider what Judge Douglas is doing every day to that end. In the first place, let us see what influence he is exerting on public sentiment. In this and like communities, public sentiment is everything. With public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. Consequently, he who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes or pronounces decisions. He makes statutes and decisions possible or impossible to be executed. This must be borne in mind, as also the additional fact that Judge Douglas is a man of vast influence, so great that it is enough for many men to profess to believe anything when they once find out that Judge Douglas professes to believe it. Henry Clay, my beau ideal of a statesman, the man for whom I fought all my humble life, Henry Clay once said of a class of men who would repress all tendencies to liberty and ultimate emancipation, that if they must, if they would do this, go back to the era of our independence and muzzle the cannon which thunders its annual joyous return, they must blow out the moral lights around us. They must penetrate the human soul and eradicate there the love of liberty. And then, and not till then, could they perpetuate slavery in this country. To my thinking, Judge Douglas is, by his example and vast influence, doing that very thing in this community. He is, in my judgment, penetrating the human soul and eradicating the light of reason and the love of liberty in this American people.
Now, the second debate takes place in Freeport, Illinois, a small town also in northern Illinois. And here Lincoln has the opening, and he decides to try to put Douglas on the defensive, naturally. And he asks Douglas a series of questions about his position. And one of them is the famous, to historians, Freeport question. What Lincoln is trying to do is to show that the Dred Scott decision destroys Douglas's idea of popular sovereignty, that is, letting people in the territories decide on slavery for themselves. One of his aims is to drive deeper a wedge in the Democratic Party, which is already splitting between North and South. Even though Lincoln and Douglas are debating, Douglas as a Democrat is also having to fight off Southern complaints that he is not sufficiently supportive of slavery. So Douglas is fighting a kind of two-front war, and Lincoln, through the Freeport question, is trying to drive that division deeper, and then Douglas comes up with what he thinks is an acceptable answer. So Lincoln is first here at Freeport.
Can the people of a United States territory, in any lawful way, against the wish of any citizen of the United States, exclude slavery from its limits prior to the formation of a state constitution? If the Supreme Court of the United States shall decide that states cannot exclude slavery from their limits, are you in favor of acquiescing in, adopting, and following such decision as a rule of political action? Are you in favor of acquiring additional territory in disregard of how such acquisition may affect the nation on the slavery question?
I answer emphatically, as Mr. Lincoln has heard me answer 100 times from every stump in Illinois, that in my opinion, the people of a territory can, by lawful means, exclude slavery from their limits prior to the formation of a state constitution. Mr. Lincoln knew that I had answered that question over and over again. Slavery cannot exist a day or an hour anywhere unless it is supported by local police regulations. If the Supreme Court of the United States shall decide that a state of this union cannot exclude slavery from its own limits, will I submit to it? I'm amazed that Lincoln should ask such a question. He casts an imputation upon the Supreme Court of the United States by supposing that they would violate the Constitution of the United States. I tell him that such a thing is not possible. It would be an act of moral treason that no man on the bench could ever descend to. Are you in favor of acquiring additional territory in disregard as to how such acquisition may affect the Union on the slavery questions? The Black Republican Creed lays it down expressly that under no circumstances shall we acquire any more territory unless slavery is first prohibited in the country. I answer that whenever it becomes necessary in our growth and progress to acquire more territory, that I am in favor of it without reference to the question of slavery, and when we have acquired it, I will leave it to the people free to do as they please, either to make it slave or free territory as they prefer. We have enough now for the present, but this is a young and growing nation. It swarms as often as a hive of bees, and as new swarms are turned out each year, there must be hives in which they can gather and make their honey. In less than 15 years, if the same progress that has distinguished this country for the last 15 years continues, every foot of vacant land between this and the Pacific Ocean owned by the United States will be occupied. I tell you, increase and multiply and expand is the law of this nation's existence. You cannot limit this great republic by mere boundary lines, saying, thus far shalt thou go and no further.
This was the voice of manifest destiny that you heard, the idea that the United States just has a kind of a God-given right to expand, take over territory whenever needed. And Douglas was firmly in favor of that, although Lincoln was not. The third debate, a couple of weeks later, took place in southern Illinois, the very southern tip of Illinois, a town called Jonesboro. And here again, Douglas goes first and again goes on to the attack. Southern Illinois is settled, as I said, from the South and is deeply racist. And Douglas again appeals on this question of race. One of the things about this debate is how, which is surprising perhaps, is how explicit the racist language is in, and this is a free state, Illinois, in the politics of the middle of the 19th century. In response, Lincoln begins to expand more on his view of what the Founding Fathers intended about slavery. So, third debate.
Mr. Lincoln objects to that decision, first and mainly because it deprives the Negro of the rights of citizenship. I am as much opposed to his reason for that objection as I am to the objection itself. I hold that a Negro is not and never ought to be a citizen of the United States. I hold that this government was made on the white basis by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever and should be administered by white men and none others. I do not believe that the Almighty made the Negro capable of self-government. In my opinion, the signers of the Declaration had no reference to the Negro whatever when they declared all men to be created equal. They desired to express by that phrase white men, men of European birth and European descent, and had no reference either to the Negro, the savage Indians, the Fiji, the Malay, or any other inferior and degraded race when they spoke of the equality of men. One great evidence of that, such was their understanding, is to be found in the fact that at the time, every one of the 13 colonies was a slave-holding colony. Every signer of the Declaration represented a slave-holding constituency, and we know that no one of them emancipated his slaves, much less offered citizenship to them when they signed the Declaration. My friends, I am in favor of preserving this government as our fathers made it. It does not follow by any means that because a Negro is not your equal or mine, that hence he must necessarily be a slave. On the contrary, it does follow that we ought to extend to the Negro every right, every privilege, every immunity, which he is capable of enjoying, consistent with the good of society. When you ask me what these rights are, what their nature and extent is, I tell you that that is a question which each state of this union must decide for itself. Illinois has already decided the question. We have decided that a Negro must not be a slave within our limits. But we have also decided that the Negro shall not be a citizen within our limits.
Douglas says, why can't this union endure permanently, half slave and half free? I have said that I supposed it could not. And I will try, before this new audience, to give briefly some of the reasons for entertaining that opinion. Another form of his question is, why can't we let it stand as our fathers placed it? That is the exact difficulty between us. I say that Judge Douglas and his friends have changed them from the position in which our fathers originally placed it. I say in the way our fathers originally left the slavery question, the institution was in the course of ultimate extinction. And the public mind rested in the belief that it was in the course of ultimate extinction. I say when this government was first established, it was the policy of its founders to prohibit the spread of slavery into the new territories of the United States, where it had not existed. I have no doubt that it would become extinct for all time to come if we but readopted the policy of the fathers by restricting it to the limits it has already covered, restricting it from the new territories.
The fourth debate took place at a town called Charleston, Illinois, in central Illinois. Lincoln gives the opening address, and here is where he gives his most explicit statement, trying to respond to Douglas's charge that he believes in the equality of black and white. For those who criticize Lincoln for his bowing to racism, this is the passage that is most often quoted, and you'll hear in a minute where Lincoln gives his views about this. But this does not satisfy Douglas, as you'll see. He immediately claims that Lincoln says one thing in one part of Illinois and another thing in another part. In northern Illinois, he's much more egalitarian because anti-slavery sentiment is stronger there. In southern Illinois, he appeals to the sentiments there. Back then, without TV, internet, video, it was possible to give different speeches in different parts of the state, and many people wouldn't know it. So here is the fourth debate with Lincoln as the opening speaker.
While I was at the hotel today, an elderly gentleman called upon me to know whether I was really in favor of producing a perfect equality between the Negroes and white people. While I had not proposed to myself on this occasion to say much on that subject, yet as the question was asked of me, I thought I would occupy perhaps 5 minutes in saying something in regard to it. I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not, nor ever have been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race. I say upon this occasion, I do not perceive that because the white man is to have the superior position, the Negro should be denied everything. I do not understand that because I do not want a Negro woman for a slave, I must necessarily want her for a wife. I will also add to the remarks I have made, for I'm not going to enter at large upon this subject, that I have never had the least apprehension that I or my friends would marry Negroes if there was no law to keep them from it. But as Judge Douglas and his friends seem to be in great apprehension that they might, if there were no law to keep them from it, I give him the most solemn pledge that I will, to the very last, stand by the law of this state which forbids the marrying of white people with Negroes.
Mr. Lincoln said in his first remarks that he was not in favor of the social and political equality of the Negro with the white man. Everywhere up north, he's declared that he was not in favor of the social and political equality of the Negro, but he would not say whether or not he was opposed to Negroes voting and Negro citizenship. I want to know whether he is for or against Negro citizenship. He declared his utter opposition to the Dred Scott decision and advanced as a reason that the court had decided that it was not possible for a Negro to be a citizen under the Constitution of the United States. If he's opposed to the Dred Scott decision for that reason, he must be in favor of conferring the right and privilege of citizenship upon the Negro. I tell you in all frankness, gentlemen, that in my opinion, a Negro is not a citizen, cannot be, and ought not to be under the Constitution of the United States.
The fifth debate moves back to northern Illinois, Galesburg, another very small place. Douglas opens, and again, this may be getting repetitious, but this is really the core of their debate up to this point, is on this question of whether blacks are included in the Declaration of Independence, et cetera. And again, what the point, what the aims of the founders of the country, what is the meaning of the Declaration of Independence. Douglas again puts forward his point of view, and Lincoln attempts to defend himself against Douglas's charge about the Declaration of Independence. So this is the fifth debate. Douglas, the first speaker.
I will never conceal my opinions or modify or change them a hair's breadth in order to get votes. I tell you that the Chicago Doctrine of Lincoln's, declaring that the Negro and the white are made equal by the Declaration of Independence and by divine providence, is a monstrous heresy. The signers of the Declaration of Independence never dreamed of the Negro when they were writing that document. They referred to white men, to men of European birth and European descent, when they declared the equality of all men. Now I see a gentleman there in the crowd shaking his head. Let me remind him that when Thomas Jefferson wrote that document, he was the owner, and so continued until his death, of a large number of slaves. Did he intend to say in that declaration that his Negro slaves, which he held and treated as property, were created as equals by divine law, and that he was violating the law of God every day of his life by holding them as slaves? I say to you frankly that in my opinion, this government was made by our fathers on the white basis. It was made by white men for the benefit of white men and their posterity forever, and was intended to be administered by white men in all time to come.
I believe the entire records of the world from the date of the Declaration of Independence up to within 3 years ago, may be searched in vain for one single affirmation from one single man that the Negro was not included in the Declaration of Independence. I think I may defy Judge Douglas to show that he ever said so, that Washington ever said so, or that any living man upon the whole earth ever said so, until the necessities of the present policy of the Democratic Party in regard to slavery had to invent that affirmation. And I will remind Judge Douglas and this audience that while Mr. Jefferson was the owner of slaves, as undoubtedly he was, in speaking upon this very subject, he used the strong language that, quote, he trembled for his country when he remembered that God was just, unquote. And I will offer the highest premium in my power to Judge Douglas if he will show that he, in all his life, ever uttered a sentiment at all akin to that of Jefferson.
You see, at the end of this fifth debate, Lincoln is realizing that he cannot fight Douglas on this issue of black equality and is shifting the ground to where he feels he has an advantage, which is the right and wrong of slavery. He wants to get the debates off the issue of race and onto the issue of slavery. To us, we may feel these are interrelated issues, but at that time, they were very separate in people's minds. As you see, Illinois, a slave state, deeply racist, it was possible to be anti-slavery and still hold very racist views at the same time. So Lincoln begins to push this angle in the sixth debate, which takes place in Quincy in central Illinois, where he really begins to hammer home the moral issue of slavery and the right and wrong of slavery, and challenges Douglas to declare whether he thinks slavery is right or wrong. Douglas, though, a very seasoned debater, responds by saying, this is not an issue for politicians. It is not the role of the politician to decide moral questions. Moral questions are, by their very nature, uncompromisable. The politics is the art of the possible. He says, I as a politician, am not going to judge the morality of slavery. So here is the sixth debate, Lincoln opening at Quincy.
This controversy necessarily springs from difference of opinion. And if we can learn exactly, can reduce to the lowest elements what that difference of opinion is, we perhaps shall be better prepared for discussing the different systems of policy that we would propose in regard to that disturbing element. I suggest that the difference of opinion, reduced to its lowest terms, is no other than the difference between the men who think slavery are wrong and those who do not think it wrong. The Republican Party think it wrong. We think it is a moral, a social, and a political wrong. We think it is a wrong not confining itself merely to the persons or the states where it exists, but that it is a wrong in its tendency, to say the least, that extends itself to the existence of the whole nation. Because we think it wrong, we propose a course of policy that shall deal with it as a wrong. I suppose that in reference both to its actual existence in the nation and to our constitutional obligations, we have no right at all to disturb it in the states where it exists. And we profess that we have no more inclination to disturb it than we have the right to do it. We oppose the Dred Scott decision in a certain way, upon which I ought perhaps to address you a few words. We do not propose that when Dred Scott has been decided to be a slave by the court, we as a mob will decide him to be free. We do not propose that when any other one or 1,000 shall be decided by that court to be slaves, we will in any violent way disturb the rights of property thus settled. But we nevertheless do oppose that decision as a political rule which shall be binding on the voter. To vote for nobody who thinks it wrong, which shall be binding on the members of Congress or the President. To favor no measure that does not actually concur with the principles of that decision. I will add this, that if there be any man who does not believe that slavery is wrong in the three aspects that I have mentioned, or in any one of them, that man is misplaced and ought to leave us. While, on the other hand, if there be any man in the Republican Party who is impatient over the necessity springing from its actual presence and is impatient of the constitutional guarantees thrown around it and would act in disregard of these, he too is misplaced standing with us. Douglas has the high distinction, so far as I know, of never having said slavery is either right or wrong.
He tells you that I will not argue the question whether slavery is right or wrong. I tell you why I will not do it. I hold that under the Constitution of the United States, each state of this Union has a right to do as it pleases on the subject of slavery. I do not choose to occupy the time allotted to me in discussing a question that we have no right to act upon. If each state will only agree to mind its own business and let its neighbors alone, there will be peace forever between us. I am now speaking of rights under the Constitution and not of moral or religious rights. I do not discuss the morals of the people of Missouri, but let them settle that matter for themselves. I hold that the people of the slaveholding states are civilized men as well as ourselves, that they bear consciences as well as we, and that they are accountable to God and their posterity, and not to us. It's for them to decide, therefore, the moral and religious right of the slavery question for themselves within their own limits. Stand by that great principle, and we can go on, as we have done, increasing in wealth, in population, in power, and in all the elements of greatness until we shall be the admiration and terror of the world. We can go on and enlarge as our population increases, and we require more room until we make this continent one ocean-bound republic. Under that principle, the United States can perform that great mission, that destiny which Providence has marked out for us. We have this great mission to perform, and it can only be performed by adhering faithfully to that principle of self-government on which our institutions were all established. I repeat that the principle is the right of each state, each territory, to decide the slavery question for itself, to have slavery or not, as it chooses.
And finally, the seventh debate takes place at Alton, Illinois. Alton, as some of you may know, was famous or infamous as the site where 20 years earlier, the abolitionist editor Elijah P. Lovejoy had been murdered by a mob defending his printing press. The mob was trying to destroy his newspaper office. He was trying to defend it, and he was shot and killed and became a martyr to the cause of freedom of the press and freedom of speech in the United States. So the slavery issue is particularly sensitive, one might say, in Alton. It's right across the river, actually, just opposite St. Louis, in a slave state of Missouri, right across the Mississippi River. Now, in keeping with the fact that President Obama has decided to identify himself with Lincoln and not with Douglas, we are only going to have Lincoln's great statement from the seventh debate, where he basically sums up his position on slavery and the whole question of the right or wrong of slavery. So this is Lincoln from the seventh and last debate.
Does not this question of slavery make a disturbance outside of political circles? Does it not enter into the churches and rend them asunder? What divided the great Methodist Church into two parts, North and South? What has raised this constant disturbance in every Presbyterian General Assembly that meets? What disturbed the Unitarian Church in this very city 2 years ago? What has jarred and shaken the great American Tract Society recently, not yet splitting it, but sure to divide it in the end. Is this the work of politicians? Is it not a false statesmanship that undertakes to build up a system of policy upon the basis of caring nothing about the very thing that everybody does care the most about? How many Democrats are there about here who have left slave states and come into the free state of Illinois to get rid of the institution of slavery? I will ask you if the policy you are now advocating had prevailed when this country was in a territorial condition, where would you have gone to get rid of it? Where would you have found your free state or territory to go to? And when hereafter, for any cause, the people in this place shall desire to find new homes, if they wish to be rid of the institution, where will they find a place to go? Now, irrespective of the moral aspect of this question, as to whether there is a right or wrong in enslaving a Negro, I am still in favor of our new territories being in such a condition that white men may find a home, may find some spot where they can better their condition, where they can settle upon new soil and better their condition in life. I am in favor of this not merely for our own people who are born amongst us, but as an outlet for free white people everywhere, the world over, in which Hans and Baptiste and Patrick and all other men from all over the world may find new homes and better their conditions in life. On this subject of treating slavery as a wrong and limiting its spread, let me say a word. Has anything ever threatened the existence of this union, save and except this very institution of slavery? What is it that we hold most dear amongst us? Our own liberty and prosperity. What has ever threatened our liberty and prosperity, save and except this institution of slavery? If this is true, how do you propose to improve the condition of things by enlarging slavery, by spreading it out and making it bigger? You may have a wen or a cancer upon your person and not be able to cut it out lest you bleed to death. But surely it is no way to cure it to engraft it and spread it over your whole body. That is the real issue. That is the issue that will continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. They are the two principles that have stood face to face from the beginning of time and will ever continue to struggle. The one is the common right of humanity, and the other the divine right of kings. It is the same principle in whatever shape it develops itself. It is the same spirit that says, you work and toil and earn bread, and I'll eat it. No matter in what shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race, it is the same tyrannical principle.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are going to take a few questions from the audience, but before doing that, I guess I should tell you the end of the story. It's hard to say who won the election of 1858 in Illinois, because in fact, as I said, they were not voting for the candidates for Senate, they were voting for members of the legislature. And if you add up all the votes for Republicans, they got about 125,000 votes, and Democrat candidates got 121,000 votes. But because of the apportionment of the districts, in Illinois, the Democrats actually won control of the legislature. Therefore, Stephen A. Douglas was reelected to the Senate and Lincoln was defeated. But of course, the debates had made Lincoln, for the first time, a truly national figure. In 1860, he came here to New York and delivered his great Cooper Union speech in February 1860, just down the way. And he was nominated for president in 1860 as the Republican Party candidate, with Douglas as the candidate of the Democratic Party. But the Democratic Party then split, and Southerners who didn't like Douglas nominated their own candidate. And of course, then another whole long saga of history took place, which we will not go into now, with the Civil War, the emancipation of the slaves. But the one point I do want to make before we go to some questions is that the greatness of Lincoln, I think, is his capacity for growth, for change. And during the Civil War, Lincoln changed enormously. He was in a very different place on these basic issues of slavery, of race, of citizenship, of nationality, when he died, than some of the things you heard in the speeches of 1858. He for the first time allowed African Americans to come into the Union Army in separate units, but in 1863. And the service of 200,000 black soldiers in the Civil War really changed Lincoln's view about this question of citizenship. And by the end of the war, he was advocating at least limited black suffrage or partial black suffrage in the South, as a consequence of the emancipation of the slaves. Lincoln was the first president ever to meet with black people in the White House. Before the Civil War, he had had almost no contact with any blacks except a couple who worked as domestic servants in his home. Now he met with people like Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth and great abolitionists and learned from them. And his racial views mellowed or matured, and he began thinking seriously about the future of the United States as a biracial society. Of course, he was assassinated before his views had, you know, reached fruition. We don't know where he would have ended up. But as I say, the Lincoln-Douglas debates are a pivotal moment in Northern politics and American history and in Lincoln's emergence on the stage of history and as a step toward his greatness during the Civil War. So let me end there and just invite for a few minutes if anyone has a question. Yes, in the back. Go ahead.
This is just a matter of curiosity. You say that all of these debates were extemporaneously done. I know that there are two shorthand techniques that exist today, handwritten techniques. What existed back then are those notes that were made by these photographers.
Yeah, you know, what happened was the Chicago Tribune, leading newspaper of the West, hired a stenographer. I don't know exactly what shorthand system he used to actually transcribe the debates. And so within a day or two, they were printed and circulated all over the country, really, reprinted in newspapers. And then later, Lincoln took all these transcripts, edited them a little bit, and then had them published as a book in the following year. So there was a stenographer taking down shorthand transcription, and so I think we are pretty confident that this is really pretty much what they actually said at that time. Of course, there was no mechanical recording or anything like that, and there are no texts of these speeches. All of Lincoln's other great speeches, we have written texts, but they did speak extemporaneously, and obviously, unlike some of our recent presidents, they were able to put grammatical English sentences together. Yes?
You obviously excerpted this from 3 hours. What were some of the other main...
Well, you know, there's a tremendous repetition in these debates. So even though we had repetition in these excerpts, one could just have more and more and more of the same. There were other issues debated which are really trivial to us. There was a long debate. Douglas accused Lincoln of having been present in 1854 where some very radical anti-slavery resolutions were passed at a Republican meeting. Lincoln insisted he wasn't there. He had nothing to do with them. That went back and forth for several, as parts of several debates. There was a lot of debate about Lincoln in Congress during the Mexican War. Did he not support the troops, and Lincoln had to explain his view on the Mexican War and why he was opposed to it, and yet he voted, he said, for military appropriations. But what's interesting is the slavery issue was really the major thing. You know, when you sometimes there are historians who claim slavery was not the real cause of the Civil War. There was the tariff, or there was internal improvements. They didn't mention the tariff once. They didn't mention internal improvements. This was what was on the agenda of the nation. The question of slavery, the subordinate question of the rights of black people, that's what people wanted to hear about. And they went over and over and over it again and again. Yes, and then we'll take you. Go ahead.
The difference why Lincoln, there weren't people, there was not an economic situation, it was
right.
Ideal. I don't know whether these people, these two guys, if they had to say what Obama became, there was an economic, which motivated and also elegance, but it was an economic.
Yeah, no, you're entirely right.
Social change was not ready because there was no economic.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, the country was in a recession at this time. In 1857, there was the so-called panic of 1857. It wasn't that serious, but there was an economic downturn. And yet, that was not really debated very much.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, there are a million reasons. The Emancipation Proclamation is what we in the history business call overdetermined. That is, there are dozens of reasons why the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. It was a military measure. It was a diplomatic measure. It was a measure to weaken the Confederacy by undermining the, you know, foundation of the economy. It was a way of getting black soldiers into the Union Army because Lincoln realized you have to offer people freedom if they're going to be fighting and dying for the Union. And it was a result of tremendous popular pressure in the North by abolitionists, by radicals, and by the fact that slaves themselves were running away from plantations as the war went on and forcing the Lincoln administration to start making policy about slavery. So this is a much very complicated and much too long for now, but there were innumerable reasons why Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Yes?
I'd like to know why today we can't have real debate.
We should.
On ABC and CBS and NBC, 2 hours without a moderator, with each candidate challenging each other, putting each other on the offensive and the defensive, and fighting it out. Like real men.
Real men.
Like real politicians.
Well, you know, I don't know if we have the attention span anymore for this in a TV world of sound bites. Nonetheless, I sympathize. I think the way presidential debates have evolved lately makes them pretty ridiculous, actually. You have a moderator, so your time is up. You've got 10 seconds for this, 20 seconds in responses, and you know, and they're not allowed to address each other, really, except on occasion. I think this is a better system. One guy gives a speech, the other guy responds to it. There you go. They go back and forth on their issues, and you get a real sense of the point of view and the tactics of. So maybe we can see if Obama really is an admirer of Lincoln. Maybe that's what he'll have to do. Who are you pointing at?
There are two over there. I don't know if you can see.
Okay, way in the left. Let's take the woman far left, and then the one over here. No, yes, that's you. Yes. Well, you know, we missed many opportunities, but I think the reason we did was that Southerners were just not willing to give up their slaves. It is true that slavery was abolished in the British Empire by Act of Parliament, but remember, the slaves were very far away from Parliament. There were very few slaves. There were no slaves in England at the, and hardly any black people there. So here you had this unusual situation of a powerful, gigantic, really, 4 million slaves in 1860, gigantic system embedded within the society, not in a colony far away. And as these debates show, the crucial issue was what is going to become of these people when they are free? Now, Lincoln actually, and Henry Clay, his ideal of a statesman, as one of the excerpts mentioned, Lincoln actually favored for a long time what they call colonization, that is, sending them to Africa or to Haiti or somewhere else, because he said they cannot live as equals here, and therefore they should be in their own nation. But of course, the problem was black people didn't want to go. They considered themselves Americans, and they wanted to stay in the land of their birth. So in the first 2 years of the Civil War, Lincoln tried voluntary emancipation. He brought in the slave owners from Delaware, Kentucky, these states that were still in the Union. He said, look, we'll pay you for your slaves. We're going to buy them. We'll give you the money. You don't lose anything. We will colonize them outside the country. Start this process going in a peaceful manner, in a legal manner. Forget it, they say. And he even said, you know, if you don't do this now, you're going to lose your slaves anyway as a result of this war. They all said, forget it. No Southerner wanted to give up his slaves. That is the problem. So it's hard to see how slavery could have been ended peacefully in this country. Now, the woman in the little hat there, yes. Go ahead.
Speaking of grocery store clerk.
Yeah. Well, he spoke pretty eloquently if he was intoxicated. It's like Lincoln supposedly said when someone said, General Grant is drinking. He said, find out what he's drinking and give it to the other generals. Douglas did down liquor quite frequently. I don't know. You know, intoxicated maybe too much. He probably had a few swigs before going on the platform, but it didn't seem to impede his argumentative prowess. Yes, ma'am, down here. And wore a top hat.
My question is, I thought General Fremont wrote an emancipation.
Yes, that's right. In 1861, General Fremont out in Missouri, where there was a civil war within the civil war, got so fed up that he said, we're going to just free all the slaves here to stop these rebels from... And that was in August 1861. But Lincoln, at that point, had not made any policy on slavery. And he rescinded it. He said, no, we can't have generals making these policies. The president is going to make the policy, and it is not yet the time to do this. Because he was very afraid of alienating these northern slave states that were still in the Union. There were four slave states that did not secede. And Lincoln was afraid Kentucky, et cetera, would leave the Union if he pushed on this. So, yes, Fremont issued the first proclamation of emancipation, but Lincoln rescinded it and fired Fremont, who wasn't a very good general anyway. Yes. Yes. Well, yeah, was there a tradition of oratorical skill? Yes, indeed. This was a time of great oratory and oratory everywhere. You know, there was no TV, there were no movies, there were no professional sports, really, pop singers. The politicians were the larger-than-life cultural heroes, you know. They had nicknames. Henry Clay was Harry of the West, you know. Douglas was the Little Giant. Later on, James G. Blaine was the plumed knight. Well, you know, Obama is an admirable figure, but most of our politicians, you wouldn't think of calling him a plumed knight. So these were larger-than-life figures. As Lincoln says in one of these excerpts, Douglas was an important guy. People believed things because Douglas said them. So, and oratory was extremely important. All of the, you know, the great figures of this time, Webster, Clay, Calhoun, and these, they were masters of oratory. And this was a time when people listened. You know, these ordinary farmers came to Quincy, Illinois, and stood there for 3 hours listening to these speeches. They didn't just doze off or go away. There was an audience for that kind of oratory. Where did Lincoln get it? Well, Lincoln had 1 year of formal schooling in his entire life, which makes you wonder if my profession is even necessary. Lincoln was utterly self-educated. Where did he learn it? He learned it by reading great oratory. Interesting fact, there was a book, very popular book at that time, called The Columbian Orator, which had excerpts from great speeches throughout history, back to the ancient day. Lincoln read it as a young man. Frederick Douglass read it as a slave. Both of them learned oratory from reading these great speeches. And then, of course, Lincoln was a lawyer, and a lot of courtroom you know, in give and take was involved persuasion of a different kind. But yeah, it's a different political system. And of course, these guys wrote their own speeches. They didn't have speech writers. They didn't have spin doctors to go on TV and tell people what they just said. You know, different political world. We may have, yeah, we have time maybe for two more questions. So yes, you go ahead, Miss Ivy. Choose her. Who are you pointing at? There you go. Go ahead. Lincoln was a politician, so maybe Honest Abe and a politician don't really go together. But you know, Lincoln, I think there were nuances of difference in Northern and Southern Illinois. And of course, as we heard, Douglas accused Lincoln of doing that. But on the basic points, he said the same thing everywhere. Slavery is wrong. Blacks are entitled to the basic rights of the Declaration of Independence. We have to stop slavery from spreading. We cannot deal with it where it exists. It's protected by the Constitution, but we have to go for its ultimate extinction somehow. He said that Northern Illinois, Southern Illinois, Central Illinois. There were nuances of different, no question about it. But I think on the basic points, and Douglas did the same thing. They had very, very well thought out and worked out positions, and they pretty much stuck to them. So I don't think Lincoln was duplicitous or anything like that. I want to actually ask a question to our two actors here. One second. I'll take you in a second. I would like to ask either or both of you, since you were reading 19th century language and oratory, how you feel as a 21st century, now of course you're doing Shakespeare too, which goes back even further, but how does this oratory strike you as actors? Is it different from what you're used to conveying on the stage? Is it a little stilted, old, or is it something that is impressive in a sense as theater, so to speak? Because these are theatrical events as well as political ones, these debates.
Right.
Access, you know, that they're just, they obviously had a charisma that made them interesting to listen to, aside from, I mean, I think it's always fascinating to listen to somebody who has that brilliance of mind, who can use the language in such a way that they can say these wonderful things in such compelling ways. But the language is stilted for our time, mm-hmm. and reading through it, I had to stop a couple.
Right. Right.
How does it end? You know,
right.
It's a little confusing.
Okay.
Did you? I would echo everything that Dana says, but it's amazing to me that they were able to talk like this. They were just simply able to get up there, and I'm sure they had some notes, but they just put it all together in their heads and managed to connect it for 10, 15, 20 minutes. I mean, it's an hour mm-hmm. and a half. It's amazing.
It's a different political world. Yes, the young lady over here. Very good question. Actually, they knew, as Douglas says in the very first thing, they knew each other for 20 years. They had both started out in Illinois politics in the 1830s. They both lived around Springfield. Some people think that Douglas courted Mary Todd before Lincoln married her, or decided he didn't want to marry Mary Todd, and he eventually married an even richer woman. You know, by the way, Lincoln pulled himself up by his own bootstraps from poor beginnings, but marrying a rich woman didn't help either. Didn't hurt either, I should say. He got ahead through various means. But and then Douglas married a woman who was the daughter of a big Mississippi plantation owner. But they actually debated each other in 1840 in the presidential campaign, where Lincoln was supporting the Whig and Douglas is supporting the Democrat, and they went around for a while debating the issues then, but they didn't mention slavery at all then. Then they're debating the tariff, economic issues. You say that's what was being debated in 1840. So they did know each other for a long, long time. Lincoln probably was jealous of Douglas. Douglas had risen to being the most powerful politician in the country. Lincoln's political career, as he himself said at one point, was a flat failure at that time. He didn't get anywhere in the legislature. He didn't get even renominated for Congress. He tried to get elected to the Senate in 1854 and lost. That was in a legislative battle, not a big campaign like this. So they knew each other, but their paths had diverged. And if you were looking in 1858, you'd have to say Douglas was a far more successful guy than Lincoln was. One more question. The woman in the very, very back, far back row, okay? Well, historians are often asked, what would Lincoln think of this, that, or the other thing? And that is, of course, an impossible question to answer. Lincoln was a very humane person. I think he would have been disturbed by unequal treatment of people today of any particular background. But Lincoln was also a product of a different world. The 19th century world was a very different world, and it's really not possible to know what Lincoln would have thought today. I'm sure he probably would have thought it was a great watershed to see an African-American man elected president of the United States. It's taken, 150 years, basically, since the emancipation of the slaves for that to happen. So Lincoln's legacy is still with us. So anyway, let me thank you all and thank the actors, particularly, for those wonderful renditions.